We are podcasting from inside the archive room. Welcome to the Year 12 English Podcast. In this podcast episode, we're going to be listening to an analysis of the longest memory. The audio for this podcast comes from a YouTube series produced by a teacher by the name of Mrs. Williams. It is addressed to her Year 11 class, but obviously relevant to us for our Year 12 study. In this episode, we will be looking at chapters 6 through to the epilogue of The Longest Memory.
So now we're looking at chapter 6, Plantation Owners of Longest Memory. And this chapter is from the perspective of Mr. Whitechapel. And it's written in the second person, that is you. Okay, you are split in two, see down here. So remembering from studies we've done in the past of other texts, the second person is used to powerfully put the reader into the position of that character. It's in the second person, but when he's talking to himself, he's using the first person, and that's in italics. So I leave my plantation to face the ridicule of my peers. You can see the opening line. And so basically in this chapter, Mr. Whitechapel is leaving the plantation after the death of Chapel. So he's got back, he's had those two conversations with Mr. Sanders and with Whitechapel, and now he's going out and facing his peers. So that's his fellow plantation owners. And he's filled with a deep sense of shame. And he's seeking to remove his shame and restore his reputation. And we'll see throughout the chapter how he does that. So he knows he's going to be ridiculed and mocked. And that's because in the eyes of his peers, he has quite lenient views on slavery, and they the other plantation owners will mock him for his views and also the death that's happened on his property, despite his views, I guess. So in the beginning, on the first page, he's preparing himself for that, the derision. That's the mocking. And I did notice here that he's heading to the club that his father and friends helped build. And I just noticed that generational impact of slavery, both the slaves, which is seen in Whitechapel, and the children and children's children and even great-grandchildren. And here, the owners of the slaves, the plantation owners, are also generational. And it's heading to his gentleman's club or his country club. He's boosting himself up by, I am a Whitechapel here. And knowing that he's going to be mocked by these lions, not men, he's giving himself courage before he goes in. And then he comes face to face with them. And the first thing that happens when he enters the room is there's this cheering. They're doing hip hip hooray. They congratulate him, congratulating him. Basically, the symbolism of that is the fact that they are cheering death. They are happy about this slave dying. They're celebrating this cruel punishment resulting in a death. and it reinforces the horror of the views of slavery at the time. And he knows he's being whipped by their sorry, he knows he's being mocked by the congratulations, and he's defending himself. It was just a lesson that went wrong. And the other plantation owners say that it's a long overdue lesson. They see him as soft and that he should have punished slaves like that long ago. And here, Mr. Whitechapel defends himself, saying the death of one slave, just because this happened to one slave, doesn't mean that I'm like you. So the rest of you think that it's okay to beat slaves. I don't think that. And they say it makes you a fool and a hypocrite. And they're mocking his views. They think that his way of running the plantation and his way of running the slaves is wrong. And so, for a couple of pages here, there's dialogue between Mr. Whitechapel and his peers. And for the first time, we really realize the type of peer pressure that Mr. Whitechapel experiences by being the only one in his peer group with his particular view. And the modern reader will see his view as harsh, but at the time, his view was considered lenient or soft. And so, if you read these pages, 68, 69, 70, 71, there's a lot of dialogue. And we hear the voices of the plantation owners who represent the dominant view in the South of slavery at the time. So you'll see, for example, Mr. Whitechapel defending himself, saying, I treat my slaves with humanity. And they're saying you should have given them cruelty. They're trying to taunt him into admitting he felt alive as the boy was killed. They say, Mr. Whitechapel, you've acted superior, you've been vain. So they're just attacking him and his views. They accuse him of being an abolitionist, which is somebody who wants to abolish slavery. And at the time, they're saying, string him up, which is he deserved to be executed. And again, the view of being a Christian and the irony and hypocrisy of that view of Christianity going hand in hand with slavery is there as well. They accuse Mr. Whitechapel of treating the Africans better than white Christian brothers, which is perhaps one of the views of one of the views of slavery at the time. They call Mr. Whitechapel's ways erroneous. And Mr. Whitechapel himself goes into some moments of shame and guilt and grief. He thinks that he used this policy of a judicious whip, judicious meaning just. Okay. But there's no such thing as a just whipping. There's only one whip and it eats flesh. Remember, that's the personification we saw in the first opening chapter. And here Mr. Whitechapel says that the whip, he's saying that the whip is corrupt and it results in brother killing brother. Now there's symbolism here. Perhaps Diagua's symbolism is that we're all brothers in the human race. But at the time, obviously, this is referring to Sanders and Chapel, who were brothers. And he then starts to, or begins to recount how it happened and the fact he wasn't there, and gets caught up in some philosophical discussions about Christianity and slaves again on page 73. And the view, our slave plantations put the pork on our plates. This idea that because we had slaves, we were able to provide for our families. And I guess there is a fear that without slavery, their businesses will go bankrupt. So what about to our children, our responsibility for our children? So if you have a look on this page, I think we're looking at 74. Should we free our stock? Now, this stock obviously means the slaves. So again, they're considered like property. But where will that leave our offspring? So there's a fear that without slavery, there will be economic ruin. And our children will be white slaves if we don't have slavery, black slaves. Mr. Whitechapel says there has to be another way to organize the economy, and they can't see it. And down here, they start talking about Whitechapel the slave. And what will happen if you free him? And what happens if you free him? Well, they'll try and make the plantation pay him for his 100 years of slave work, or his arrears. This is the things that he's owed. And I guess this, there's a connection here to the stolen generation and those views that the indigenous people had their children stolen from them, and the government didn't want to apologize because they were afraid that if they did apologize and took responsibility, then people would sue them and they'd have to pay money. And this idea of, you know, we can't say we're sorry, we can't accept wrong responsibility, we can't change things just in case something sort of, then we have to pay for it with our finances as well, make up for it with our finances. At the top of page 75, we'll come to this idea of the defense of Whitechapel. And this is how, and Whitechapel here is the slave. And this is how Mr. Whitechapel restores his honor. He speaks highly of his slave Whitechapel, noble, honourable and true. He's living proof that our slaves are equal in every way. Um, back on page 76, he admits that Chapel and Mr. Sanders shared the same father. So he announces this news to all of his peers, this thing that he's kept hidden for so long. But he tells them because he's trying to prove Whitechapel's nobility. So he tells the story. Sanders Sr., well, he raped my slave's mistress. So the son, Chapel, was born from him. And they're now shocked. They're saying, unbelievable. We've not heard this. If it wasn't from your lips, we wouldn't believe it. And they then say, well, how can Whitechapel watch and not intervene? So how could your Whitechapel not step in? He lost a son in deference to authority. So he lost his son because he didn't disobey the order to keep that a secret. And they recognize that that Whitechapel, the slave, his loyalty is so strong that he didn't disobey his order, his master's order to keep it a secret. And now they're trying to buy Whitechapel. Name your price. That slave of yours is a slaver's dream. So they're trying to, the peers are trying to purchase Whitechapel. Mr. Whitechapel says he's not for sale. If he were white, he would still be rare. So he's got quality, nobility. And the other peers, plantation owners, now drink a toast to Whitechapel and his slaves. And they're toasting to him. Though Chapel is gone, there's still Whitechapel. Chapel's dead. The whip is buried, so never to be used again. And old Whitechapel is there still, loyal beyond requisition of duty. And it was like by the other peers recognizing the loyalty of Whitechapel, they want to buy Whitechapel from him. He feels like Mr. Whitechapel, he feels like his name is restored. So he feels perhaps vindicated by his way of raising slaves. He feels like he's been able to earn the honor of his peers back. He's got the respect of the other plantation owners because of Whitechapel's. So he has the respect of the other plantation owners again because of Whitechapel's loyalty and obedience. He feels vindicated. So that's the end of chapter 6. Hopefully you've got some really good notes there that will help you with this chapter. And so now we're going to look at chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10. It starts obviously with chapter 7, which is from the perspective and the voice of Lydia. Lydia is the daughter of Mr. Whitechapel. So she is the plantation owner's daughter. These chapters investigate and explore the relationship of Lydia and Chapel, which begins as a platonic friendship. It says here in the first sentence, I begin as his big sister. So Lydia starts off having feelings of sisterly feelings, friendship and camaraderie. But beginning as the big sister kind of implies that this changes, and we discover as the chapters go on that it develops into a romantic relationship. And so in the first chapter, and the voice of Lydia decides to teach him to read. And it's a secret. She puts her fingers to her lips. Shh. Okay. And here in the middle of page 81, we see how excited Chapel is as he begins to read. So you can see here, he says them all with the same exhilarated voice. He's close to shouting them out. So he's excited about learning. And later on we read here, this is the day he reads to me, not a few words, but page after page with occasional help. He's very intelligent. He's learnt so quickly to read. And the next page. This appears later on as well, but Lydia has a real sense of injustice at illiteracy. She recognizes the right to be literate for all people. So she's taught him to read but not write, and she realizes she's been foolish. And so here she teaches him to write as well as read. And then it moves on to chapter 8, which is there the voice of Cook, so Chapel's mother. And she hears him reading. Down the bottom here, she says, she hears a voice that's my son's and not my son's. I hear my son's voice as speaking as I have never heard it before. He sounds as if he is standing at a pulpit, or like the master sounds when he says prayers to the whole plantation. He sounds confident. He sounds intelligent. There's this tone of pride, but also surprise at Chapel reading. Chapel speaking. Words from a book. Here, my Chapel. My Chapel. Here is the sense of pride here. He's mine, my son. Okay. And then later over on page 85, here it's even more direct, talking about the pride in her son. All I feel inside is pride. Not fear, not yet. Just pride. It's swelling my chest and filling my heart. My son can open a book and sound like the master. I stare at the pot and smile. So this sense of pride here from him, from Chapel's mother. And later at the bottom of 85 is when the worry starts. Okay. He's just out of my sight when a worry replaces him. She's proud but fearful. Books will only bring you trouble. But she doesn't want to stop him reading, and she doesn't want to get Whitechapel to do it either. She decides to keep his secret. She knows that if she tells Whitechapel, "Husband, I love you and tell you everything, there's one thing I cannot tell you, because I know what you would do if you knew about it. You would tell my son that he cannot read." Okay. And so there's this contrast here. Whitechapel's fear contrasted with Cook's hope for their son. And so she decides to keep it a secret. And here, chapter 9. You turn over there. Um, Here is the beginning of the romance between Lydia and Chapel. She's listening to his voice, Chapel's voice, and she realizes that she's in love with the cadence. Now, this is 2 years in, 2 years after she starts teaching him to read. But then, Mr. Whitechapel walks in. So this is what we read at the end of chapter 5, Chapel, where that is in poetry form. It's described there as well from Chapel's perspective, but we're reading this same point from Lydia's perspective. So father walks in, her father walks in and sees them reading together. She's reading Shakespeare's plays and he yells at them both. She's scared for Chapel. But she also realizes that she's in love with him. He's 3 years younger than her, but she's in love with him, in love with a slave, and Chapel is in trouble because of me. And the father says that they must not read together, they must not write, must not sit together in the house, they must not write notes to each other, and they must not speak of it to anybody. And he says, "You have done him a grave injustice by teaching him to read and write." Now here, Lydia says, or wants to say, a law which says a slave should not read and write is unjust. So I made a note here, Lydia's political belief, her belief in the right for slaves to be literate, for slaves to be able to read and write, that was not a popular view at the time, but it shows a range of beliefs that were held at the time, that there were people who believed in the rights of slaves to be literate and the rights of slaves to be free. They just faced such great peer pressure. Their views were so rare or so uncommon that it was very hard for their voices to be heard at the time. And then Cook arranges a bit of a secret meeting. She kind of suggests that there's a special place that you can look at the heavens. And when Lydia goes out, she finds there is Chapel. And they agree to meet regularly or meet again. And because he's promised, he's honourable, Chapel is honourable, he cannot disobey the command, the promise he made to Mr. Whitechapel. He gave him his word, so he won't read or write, but he asks Lydia to memorise something, kind of like getting around a bit of a loophole of that promise he made. Chapel, I want to say, all my memory is yours. Again, there's another link there to the title, The Longest Memory. So Lydia decides she will devour father's library. She will fill her head with your words. And they declare their love for each other. They even decide to face back to back so that they're not facing each other. That's along here somewhere too. If we go on to chapter 10. So Lydia grows up, grows into a woman. And as a woman, she has this parade of men coming through the house, a stream of visits by eminent eligible young men. So the marriage is to be arranged. There's this implication that that's the role for women, that they have no other role other than to get married. There's no other thing that girls can do. But she compares each of those men to Chapel, and none are as intelligent. They none have his wit, charm, or sensitive nature, not one. And she disagrees with them all with their views on slavery, all of the men that she meets. Her father tries to convince her to get married. He are talking in metaphors here, but she says, well, I'm not ready, but she's speaking in metaphors. What a shame to force a sapling to become a tree before it's ready to blossom. She's basically saying, I'm not ready to get married yet. Page 95. She's now here wishing that he were white or that she were black. That's because at the time, obviously, biracial marriages were not accepted. And so there was no way for them to be together. They were from very different worlds. Now here, Thomas, who is Lydia's brother, comes back from the north, that's the north of the United States, and tells stories of free blacks associating with white women, and there is venom in his tone, there's poison in his tone, and distaste in his face. So we see his shock. It is unacceptable at the time in the South. Now she, Lydia, is disguising her smile. So she's excited about that. She's happy to hear that, but she has to hide her reaction. And she hears about this heaven on earth from her brother. She calls it heaven on earth. So we see here, this is paradise. Remember in the first chapter, Whitechapel says why they keep talking about this paradise. Well, here we learn where Chapel has gotten this idea, where Chapel gets the idea that there is a place, paradise, that he can run away to. And there's a reference up here to Shakespeare's plays. And there's definitely a connection to Romeo and Juliet, or a comparison between the story of Romeo and Juliet from two families that were enemies, the Montagues and the Capulets, and here in the story of Lydia and Chapel. That society would never allow them to be together. And for the first time in their secret meetings, Chapel faces Lydia in defiance of the ban. So that promise he's made. He kisses her and he says, I cannot live this way. So Lydia says, think about going to the north. She's trying to convince him that there is a place where she can be happy there. Now, Lydia is romantic. She's full of idealism. But the modern reader perhaps can see and question, would she really be able to, would he really be able to run away together? And she's making a plan here to run away as well, travel separately up north and then meet each other. Now we know how venomous, you look up here, how much venom up there, how much venom there was and distaste there was at the romances between the black and the white up north from Thomas, her brother. Don't know whether, I think from a modern reader, we think perhaps Thomas or the father wouldn't allow her to run away. But her idealistic view, Lydia's idealistic view, believes that she can actually find a new life with Chapel. So they decide they're going to run away together. He said he's hoping it wouldn't come to this. He didn't want to disobey his father, but his love is so strong for Lydia that no one, not his father, not her father, not even his mother, can stop. He decides, north. We're going north to paradise. Two new guests. So they make a plan to run away to the north together. And she, Lydia, kind of gets herself an invitation or to go with her brother back north. So she's making her plans to go. She convinces her father to let him go. She says her reason that she's met all the men in the south and she's not impressed, so she has to go north to find a man. Mother hears about it and says no, but then the top of page 101, Lydia says, Mum, you should come too. Mother, you should accompany me. Chapel says, oh, this is a bad idea. Your mother will not let us run away. She will keep an eye on you. She will soldier you. And Lydia says, do you think I'm not a better planner than that? This is the best response that you can muster. Okay. So she continues to make her plan by investigating what sort of accommodation there are. There is. She talks about the fact that black people cannot live alone since they might get harassed, but also because people might try and sell them even if they say they're free. And that made me think about 12 Years a Slave, where that happens, where he's a free man who gets kidnapped and then sold and becomes a slave. So there's more of this plan together. Lydia's going to give him money for food. He's going to dress properly. So there's a big plan here. They start dreaming about having children together. Chapel has a dream that he's going to write verses for a living. He's going to become a poet. And we begin to understand more, perhaps, the fact that his chapter is written in poetry. And this incredibly romantic tone is seen here at the end. It's hopeful, optimistic, perhaps naive. There's no verse that can express the depth of his feeling. And the very end of this chapter is Lydia talking about how Chapel's going to make their children's lives rich. And we know, obviously, because we know that Chapel ends up dying, we know with a sense of sadness that this will never come to pass. So that's the end of chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10. Hopefully you've got some good notes for your analysis table that you can use in your essay. So here we are looking at chapter 11, The Virginian, in The Longest Memory. This is a fictional newspaper. And I think there are 17 editorials. It's published, and an editorial represents the views of the newspaper, in particular the editor of the newspaper. And so this represents the predominantly white view of the issue of slavery at the time. Now, at the time that these editorials were written, they're over a period of about 6 months, in 1809 and 1810. This was a time where there was increasing resistance to slavery in the north of the US, whereas in the south there was a strong defense of the practice of slavery. And ultimately, in the 1860s, it ends up being the Second American Civil War, or the Second War in the United States. The Northern against the South, the Confederate against the Northern Army. But for now, it's just a time where there are a variety of views that exist. And obviously, the Virginian is from the state of Virginia. Which is one of the southern states, but it borders with it's kind of like the border between south and north. So it's the last state in the south before it becomes, I think it borders on Washington. I might see if I can find a picture for you. So here is the picture that I found, and if you see Virginia here, like I said, the northernmost southern state, and it borders on Washington, D.C. Okay, and then there's New York and these northern states here. And so, what you'll notice in the writing of these editorials is there's quite a lot of persuasive language and techniques. So, you can analyze these like you would analyze a language analysis task. You'll find repetition, you'll find emotive appeals, you'll find all of those different types of techniques that are designed to try and appeal to people's emotions and logic on that issue of slavery. And there's a number of, I guess, related issues to do with slavery that it goes through. The first is simply about whether, I guess, is it compatible with Christianity to wield a whip? And the second, which I thought was probably a more interesting one for us to analyze here, was a few months later. And this in particular, we can see the barbarity of the view at the time. And modern readers certainly recognize the barbarity of this view. There's a very dehumanizing tone when discussing slaves. In the beginning, slaves are talked about in terms of being stock, being owned or possessed. And it discusses, well, should we worry about a woman and her child being sold separately? And the question of here, are we to attribute to slaves all the qualities we credit to ourselves as human beings? I think not. And I guess this is bringing up a major issue with slavery at the time, that the way that slavery was justified because people asserted that the African slaves were lower forms of life. They were not like human beings. They considered them different, like a different species. and therefore they didn't have to follow principles of Christianity in the way that they treated them. And that was the way that they could, I guess, reconcile or put alongside their Christian faith with their mistreatment, that it was just like mistreating an animal. Again, modern readers realize the ridiculousness, realize that this view is uncivilized, that this view is not something to support, but readers at the time had a common view. And this is certainly represented here. They are not like us. They do not feel like we feel. They do not value what we value. So you'll notice the techniques. We've got exclusive language, they, not we and us, but they. We've got repetition. They are, they do not, they do not. Okay. We've got this analogy, the comparison with livestock. And if you come over to the next one, talks about the punishment for a slave who's a runaway, and it's 200 lashes. There's a connection here to Chapel's punishment. And earlier on in the novel, it actually says that the Virginian talks about what an appropriate punishment is. So the connection between here and the narrative in earlier in the chapters there. And there's also a debate here whether they should just kill any runaway slave. And the editor says that it's probably not a good idea. It's better to be a living reminder. A dead runaway, okay, might mean that the next slave might be tempted to run away too. Okay, and page 109. This editorial talks about the very old slave given a good life of service and now is too old to be of much use. We guess this is referring to Whitechapel, or at the very least people like Whitechapel. So the editor suggests that they should be given a lighter duty because they are a repository of wisdom here, that they shepherd young children, and the advice is to keep your old slaves around the plantation and see what they can contribute. On the next page, this editorial halfway through June 1810. This one is about the temptation that young slaves offer. And it is advising that people avoid temptation so they don't actually take it upon themselves to assault or rape black slave women. There's a connection, obviously, to what happened with Chapel and Cook. So here is the offspring have no place as slaves. So the offspring as of a slave and an owner shouldn't be slaves, but they shouldn't also be in the household of the overseer or the master. So they're between two worlds. They don't belong in either world, and certainly this is also referring to Chapel's situation. And here, right at the very end, 2 days ago I heard of a slave who was whipped to death by an overseer who subsequently, later, learned that the slave was his half-brother, and this is certainly referring to the specific situation of Chapel. Okay, so the next one has this basic question of, is Christianity incompatible with slavery? Certainly a topic or a theme that's addressed in other areas of this novel as well. And it says that, well, of course we can have slaves and be Christians. That's the standard answer that the Virginian gives. It says that Christianity is a faith and slavery is just a physical, material well-being. Christianity looks after the soul, one's exterior, that's slavery, the other interior. Christianity, one's tangible and intangible. Tangible, slavery. Intangible is the faith. So he really explores this idea of justifying Christianity, justifying slavery using Christianity. And we keep going on to the next story, so the next editorial. It's basically whether plantation owners should be firm or kind, and it's sort of the two sides. The kind approach say that those who say we should be kind say that the number of runaways are lower. They say that it increases profit. But some people who say that the firm approach is better, they say that the harsh punishments are essential. But he's saying that they should be not firm or kind, but fair. There's a final sentence, the lot of the slaves need not be miserable. My note for the top here was that there was a very much a patronizing tone here. And that is that it seems to be advocating kindness. It seems to be saying we need to be kind to our slaves, but actually they're kind of treating them as inferior beings in the way that they discuss it. They're treating them like children or even like dogs here. So that's important that we analyze that. The next one answers the question of if slavery will ever come to an end. Some people say yes, some people say no. Yes, slavery will come to an end. People say that advances in techniques for manufacturing, so almost like the Industrial Revolution, will lead to it becoming cheaper for machines to do the work rather than slaves. But no was not in our lifetime. But interestingly, when they're having a conversation, will slavery will ever come to an end? When we say yes, the person who asked, his face fell. He was sad that yes, slavery will come to an end. But no, his expression became gleeful. Again, there's a incredible arrogance in that view. We're moving on. And this one from May 5th, which is the first half, we kind of jump around in time a little bit. This is before the last few editorials, but it begins a new series from Miss L, who we assume is from Lydia. And she definitely represents a very modern view. Her suggestion is that the black slaves should be paid and then they can look after themselves rather than keeping them as slaves and providing all their needs. And the editor actually considers this view, says that it does merit further consideration. And the editor says it's an intelligent question from a lady. I guess there's a sense of patronism
patronizing tone there too, that from a lady, it's an intelligent question. Like, ladies can't think of intelligent questions. We keep going. Miss L, she continues to debate this idea while discussing the economics of a plantation. And she's discussing this open market system, which is a free market. And here, May 19th, he's actually received a letter from a literate slave, that is a slave who can read and write. We assume it's from Chapel because he didn't actually write it, but he dictated it. And because of that, we know that Chapel has promised not to write himself. And so we assume that Lydia is writing it and Chapel is dictating it. So he is astonished. The editor is astonished that there is a slave who can read and write. But this particular slave has written one of the most articulate letters. Articulate means well written, well spoken. And another word for articulate might be eloquent. Okay. And he says that, well, if it benefits the plantation to have literate slaves, so be it. But write in your opinion. So he's opened up people, readers, write in your opinion. And the response, the overwhelming response, is that slaves should not be literate. A resounding no. And there was a response from a father and daughter. Now again, we assume that this is the daughter, Lydia, and the father, Mr. Whitechapel. That's just our assumption, but I think it's a pretty good one under the circumstances. So the father said no, and the daughter said yes, and about time. This issue of the theme of the importance of the of literacy and the right to education is addressed here, page 117. And she discusses the minority view that perhaps the joys of literacy should be shared to slaves and not slaves. She advocates literacy for all. And again, that's a very important view and value of Diagua that Lydia represents in the novel. She demonstrates, Lydia demonstrates intelligence and idealism. Here, the deputy of the overseer, and we assume that perhaps this could be the deputy from that plantation, from Mr. Whitechapel's plantation, is talking about the situation of the poor whites. So people are paying all these attention to slaves and plantation owners, but what about the poor whites who are also working? He says the lives of these people are barely one rung above the condition of a slave, and some of them eat better than the whites. That saying that we need to think about these poor white people rather than the slaves. Next one. Okay. And there's people who are also supporting this letter, saying that whites have been forgotten. The working class whites. Okay, if we keep going, we move to June 16th. And there is now a discussion that begins about biracial relationships. And the editor comes out firmly against them. Says there was no sight more perfidious than a white woman with a black man. And in New York, up in the north, this editor saw this and was appalled. There is so much wrong with it. What about the offspring from these heinous alliances. Heinous, vile, disgusting. So that there is a horrified, appalled tone in the words discussing the alliances that really show that the people at the time are strongly opposed to it. Interesting though, on this topic, Miss L, who's obviously Lydia, writes in and she's defending relationships between white and black, and she's citing the Constitution. And while previously the editor has thought that Miss L, Lydia, has been intelligent and had wise words to say, here she is grossly mistaken. She has a love for blacks that clouds her ability to reason. So here is where the Lydia's view and the view of the editor completely divulge. Divert, sorry. And that's the end of the series of letters to the editor. So although they are individual, standalone, lots of persuasive language, they do kind of connect to things that were happening throughout the rest of the narrative. And how we see those connections and how we write about those connections in our essay will be really important, because here we see clearly the views and values that we need to refer to in our essay and discuss. Okay, that's the end for chapter 11. Okay, so we're looking at chapter 12. Now this is titled Great Grandmother, but if you have a look on the title page, see the page of contents, it is also called Great Granddaughter. So it's actually narrated by Whitechapel's youngest great granddaughter. But it's chosen, so Diagua has chosen to leave the title here, Great Grandmother. So this is intended to imply this continuation of memory. So she is the great granddaughter of Whitechapel, but she's also a great grandmother for the future generations. So there's this generational aspect that we're not individuals, that we are in a continuum, a line of people stretching through generations. And Whitechapel is just one of that line. So that is my interpretation or my analysis of what these contrasting titles, Great Granddaughter and Great Grandmother, is intended to convey. So here we have the view of the great-grandchild, the great-granddaughter, and we learn a bit about Whitechapel's history. He left Africa when he was a boy. He was about 10 years old. He was playing in a field of tall grass. He remembers the smell, there's that sensory imagery here, even all these years later. The next moment he was marching, he was facing the sea, and it describes the journey in the sea and how as a 10-year-old boy he was alone. So here I've written that it emphasizes the injustice of slavery, that this happened so long ago, so 90 years before, and certainly shows that long memory of slavery. And if we turn over to page 123, there's the use of symbolism of lice. The lice in Africa do not bite, they tickle. But by contrast, New England lice have teeth. And I think this is intended as a metaphor, perhaps, for the difficulty of life. So the New England lice have teeth. Well, so does slavery. The New England lice symbolize the pain of slavery. And the great-granddaughter had a dream about Africa. And I believe that Africa symbolizes freedom. And Whitechapel says, what do you want to go and do something silly like dreaming about Africa for? So he's saying, why would you want to dream about freedom? Why would you want to put yourself in the position of making yourself suffer by dreaming for something that's impossible? In the dream, she flies through the air and lands in Africa. She kisses the ground. Not a kiss like a peck, but a full-mouthed kiss. And I've written here, there's a lot of symbolism in this chapter, that big full mouth kiss is symbolic of this desire or this longing for home, for her heritage, for her African roots. She knows that while she's there in Africa, she's back where she belongs. So this is connected to that Africa being a symbol of freedom. And here she's describing the dream, and there's sensory imagery in all of the different flavors. And again, this idea of the long memory is here because the great-grandfather is actually the grandchild of our son. So he's also a great-grandson. And she says, I am the third grandchild of his 12th daughter, his youngest great-grandchild. And as she describes the dream, he says, Africa is not for you. And the implication is, freedom is not for you. He says, you dream about something you don't know. You should make your dreams here. He was annoyed with her for dreaming. He didn't like it. Well, she didn't like it either. He never talked about Africa. He believed that if you talked about Africa, it would make people dream. It would make people insolent, rebellious. Said Africa was his past and not ours. If anyone had the right to dream, he did. But he chose not to, so why should anyone else? And then the great-granddaughter remembers when he got married again to Cook. And how for a while he had a bit of a smile, but his son's death deadened his eyes. And because he caused that death, we all run from him. So we avoid him. Except for my brother, who ran into him and has a permanent swelling on his forehead as a result of the collision. So that's the same story that is told earlier on by Whitechapel, one of his great-grandchildren knock him off his feet. It says here, this is a metaphor here, he is a ghost we all see and ignore because he killed his only son. It's brutally direct and honest here. She remembers that great-grandfather announced his plans to tell the master where his son had gone and how nobody agreed. Everybody thought that he'd gone crazy. But he said, there are things that I know that I can't tell you. Possibly that's his son's parentage. What things? He says, just trust me. And then there's a description of the whipping from her eyes, how the whip took a toll on her great-grandfather's body, just as it did on Chapel's. And after that day, I could do nothing for him. He shrank in stature. He became less of a person. Became less status too, less in respect. And from that day, my dreams about Africa gone. In its place are nightmares, nightmares of a beating that never ends. The whip keeps slow time. It's like a repetitive rhythm on a man's back. And she remembers the dead body here. His body is stiff. His skin is cold. And that's the end of that chapter of Chapter 12, Great-Grandmother or Great-Granddaughter, depending on which title you use.
Okay, so let's look together at Chapter 13, Sanders Jr. This is the last official chapter of the novel, and it is from the perspective of Sanders Jr. That's the son of Sanders Senior, the one who committed the murder, the whipping, and at the time he was the overseer of the plantation. And if you recall, at the end of the previous chapter, chapter 12, Great Grandmother, Whitechapel has died. And so now we shift to the perspective of Sanders Jr., who is dealing with the body. So you're really dead. And is a description of Whitechapel's dead body, curled up tight as a nutshell, peaceable. And he's thinking about Whitechapel, and he says, I like you, though I struck you with these very hands. I shouldn't have hit you, he says. He expresses this regret over hitting him while his son was being whipped, and he decides he's going to be the one to dig the grave. And he explains that I hit you because you undermined me, but I didn't really hit you hard. There was no blood. Here at the top of the next page, there's a tone of admiration in the way that Sanders Jr. talks about Whitechapel. He recognizes, you were a better overseer than I. You were out here before me, first and last, and here
he's sorry about your son. So there's regret over causing the death of his son. He calls him your son, not my brother, because he never knew him as his brother. He describes Chapel as headstrong and now realizes that he couldn't have been yours. He didn't have your common sense. He had a wild spirit and yours was tame. He also, though, doesn't see his own father in him. Still here at the bottom, still he's blaming Whitechapel. Only you could have stopped him from running. Only you could have saved him. And there's a discussion of kind of defending himself about why he whipped Chapel. He's saying that Mr. Whitechapel actually told him that they had to punish slaves who ran away. He says that it's 200 lashes and he read it in the Virginian, and you would also have read that in chapter 11. And so I had to do what I was told. It was 200 lashes it had to be. He's defending himself about why he actually whipped Chapel. It was defensiveness. Oh, Whitechapel, you were supposed to watch him. How did he slip out of your sight? What could I do? It wasn't my fault. He said even if he'd have waited until Mr. Whitechapel returned, the punishment still would have happened. Now he's coming back to Whitechapel, the slave, the old man, and looking at his dead body. He calls it a childlike way of sleeping. Now I'll bury you. You'll get a grave with a stone. I think that indicates respect. So there'll be something to keep the memory of Whitechapel alive. And he says, cover him with my jacket. He's taking off his jacket. I could never offer it to you while you lived, but now you're dead, I could. I can. And that regret, I'm sorry. I didn't knowingly kill my half-brother. I did not want to see him dead. Just a lesson taught for all to see. That's all. And he decides he wants him buried. He wants Whitechapel buried in his jacket. So perhaps there's symbolism here that he wants to give the slave Whitechapel his jacket. He wants him to wear something of his while he's buried into eternity. It belonged to my father. And he ends with, I am his son. I am my father's son. I think like him. You yourself said I resembled him. But my memory of him is sullied. He lacked your courage. If you were white, I would have wanted you as my father. The jacket is yours. So there's this really sense of admiration for Whitechapel, his qualities, his courage. And there's this recognition of the son became a copy of his father. So in the same way as Sanders Sr. whipped a man to death, We see that repeated when Sanders Jr. whips Chapel to death. And there is again a reinforcing of this idea that there's a generational passing of slavery, of owning slaves, but also views about slavery as well. And so that's the end of chapter 13. And the final chapter now is kind of like an epilogue called Forgetting. And these are like bookends. At the beginning of the novel is remembering, and then at the close of the novel it's forgetting, and it's back to the perspective of Whitechapel. Even though he's passed away in chapter 12, it's, I guess, jumping a little bit back in time to while he was still alive. And it's his thoughts, his ponderings, his memories. So he is remembering his son and remembering his attitude. One thing I noticed here, I do not care about your happiness. Your life is everything to me. I want to keep you alive. That is all. And I've written my notes, says that survival, life, is more important than happiness for Whitechapel. But that was not the case with Chapel, who thought the freedom was worth risking his life for. So this, I think there's a note in your analysis tables from the opening chapter. It's clearer here, and so I would place it under the chapter of forgetting. Then he, we realise here that Whitechapel knew about his son's love for Lydia. He hears, but he pretends that he's deaf. He doesn't want to address it. He doesn't want to know. He doesn't want to destroy the dream, perhaps. Here on page 136, Whitechapel acknowledges that he's been wrong. He says, "I am wrong in many things." And then he talks, "Maybe I am wrong to tell the master that my son is gone." So he's regretting betraying his son. And then he recognizes at the bottom here, "I have been wrong all of my days. Too much has happened to put it right." He says he would need another life, no, several lives, another 100 years, no more, to unravel this knotted mess. So he is full of regret. He realizes he has been wrong, and he doesn't fully say what he's been wrong in. Obviously, here we have it explicitly said about betraying his son, but I guess we can infer, or it's implicit here, is that he perhaps on his deathbed regrets that he has chosen survival over happiness, or chosen compliance over a desire for freedom, perhaps. He reflects here, and there's very metaphorical language that's used, with master being represented by daylight and the slave as night. But how long can the master's daylight continue to rule our nights? I guess this idea is this question, well, how long can slavery exist? And this is part of why we infer that perhaps he is actually now questioning the system of slavery that he came to accept throughout his 100 years. He's now recognizing that the master cannot hope to rule the day and the night forever. So he's recognizing that this system of slavery, with masters being all powerful, will not last forever. He's seeing the wisdom perhaps in his son's desire for freedom and his great-granddaughter's. And then he's pretty much his last coherent thought before he really starts to get heavy and tired and needing rest, and his eyes deaden. He's gradually losing light to darkness. And there's a sense of acceptance of the moment of death. His mouth is pleased to recognize death as a lifelong companion. It's always been there. There's the sharp, jerky sentences here again. He has the sourness in his mouth, but as he has his last thoughts and moments, he's saying, forget, memory is pain trying to resurrect itself. Pain of all his life that's trying to stay alive. Links again to that title, the longest memory. Perhaps it's the pain that helps it stay alive. There's this sense too that even with the death of Whitechapel, the memories of his existence, the tragedy of Chapel and his death and everything that occurred there remains firmly implanted in the hearts and minds of everybody on that plantation. The longest memory. So that's the end of the longest memory. I hope you've got some great notes in your analysis table. You've got notes with your quotes, with language techniques, with choices, with tone and vocabulary and all of that stuff, because we're going to start working on essay writing and how we can put that together in paragraphs and make a really good essay starting next week. All right. Thanks all.